Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 109 of D&D Discussions, the podcast for players and DMs alike, where we cover a wide variety of topics to help you with your games. I'm your host, Ryan Reeder, and with me, as always, is my good buddy, Ben Baumhofer. How you doing tonight, Ben?
I am in a better mood than I have been in the last few episodes, because boy, oh boy, do I love D&D and love to get to talk about it.
And you love to play it.
I do, but that's a story for another time. Like later in the episode. Yeah.
So, since we talked about it last time, status update. How far into the Lego set are you?
Okay, so I started it after we played. So because we play Saturday nights. So I started on Sunday because that's the soonest that I had time to actually get in there and do things. And even then it was kind of late in the day on Sunday, but then I had Monday off. So I was able to put more together then. And then slowly I've been trying to do it, you know, after work, you know, here and there. So first of all, it has 4 instruction booklets. I'm on one now. It has 33 bags of parts. And I just finished putting together number 17.
Oh my gosh.
So I've got like 2 of the big set pieces done, and they're together and they're over on a shelf with all the different characters and stuff. I've got the tower that I'm currently building. I've got the first floor done and I'm starting to work on the second floor of the tower. But what's cool is I've got some really cool like monsters put together. This thing is riddled with loot all over it too. And the loot's in there and stuff, except, as I was positioning something, a book that's just kind of loose, but sitting in like a little nook fell off and it's somewhere either under my desk or to my left or something. So I need to find a little Lego book, but it's somewhere. It doesn't magically disappear.
And but maybe yeah, it does.
It's really cool. It's an awesome set. Like, if you're just using it just to like play Legos, it's great. It's got a lot of different interactive pieces and stuff and like hidden things and everything. It's really neat, but it's also a blast to build and seeing all the different, like, you know, D&D references here and there, like, you know, traps, monsters. Like, I put together a little Lego gelatinous cube. Like, it's just cool and fun and stuff.
Super cool.
Plus, on Monday, while I was putting it together, I listened to the actual play that went along with the adventure that comes with it.
And yes, that released on this last Saturday.
Yes. And it was really fun. And what's great is, like, I was kind of going through and building things, and then, you know, they're pointing things out in the storyline as they're going through that I'm like in the middle of building. I'm like, oh,
because that you play through the set.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it starts off with, you know, going to a tavern, and then from there you kind of go into the grassy field in front of it, and then there's, you know, a cave entrance and stuff, and I mean it's really neat. And like I said, how there's like loot all over the place. Like, I'm building the little things of loot, and like I found places where you know, things were hidden. There's like a hidden key somewhere that's really cool. Another one, there's like a trap door here and there, and I mean it. All the stuff like functions and does stuff in the set too. So it was just a ton of fun to put together and then also just, you know, build and just have a blast with. So like I said, if you're a fan of Lego, it's a great set. If you're a fan of D&D, it's a great set. If you're a fan of both, like I am, it's like probably the best sort of like fandom marriage that Lego has had since Lego Star Wars. Like, it's just that good.
Yeah. That's super cool. And we will make sure to have a link in the show notes to the Lego actual play, mm-hmm. that they did, because it is very entertaining and, yes, and very well done. And some of the cool, like, little Lego set pieces, like the fully built Lego DM screen.
Oh, that was
and
cool.
Such are just pretty incredible builds. So very much worth it for that as well.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I mean, it's a fun little game to listen to and stuff anyway, but just doing it while I'm building, even better. So yeah.
Well, that's awesome. So we have a few things that we want to talk about for this episode. One's been kind of swimming in the back of my mind for a little while. Because I remember I was talking to a friend about world building here somewhat recently. And we were talking about different types of settings. Because, you know, obviously you can set your adventure anywhere. Like there are some things that set like D&D in modern day and or in the Wild West or sci-fi or, you know, on some post-apocalyptic thing. It's all very doable. There are maybe systems that are more catered to things like that, potentially as well. Though there are plenty of conversions you can find for 5e for those types of settings as well. In fact, I think there is an entire like Star Wars 5e conversion project that is being done that is absolutely wild in its scope. And it's incredibly cool. If you want to do Star Wars, but don't necessarily want to do a new system or don't want to get the custom dice that I think like the Fantasy Flight or I don't remember who the publisher of the latest Star Wars RPG was, but it's got some actually really unique mechanics in it. But yeah, regardless, suffice it to say, there's a lot of different conversions. There's a lot of things we talked about this last time. How 5e is such a very flexible system that you can kind of do whatever you want with it if you want to. Even if there are other things that if you have the time, the availability, or the funds to get, may be custom suited for those types of things. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to talk specifically tonight about types of magic in your setting. Most of this can be broken down into three main types. You've got your high magic, low magic, and then in some cases, no or basically no magic settings. No magic settings obviously don't work super well with D&D. Like if you wanted to run a specifically custom campaign with and have one of your limitations be like no spellcasters and just stick to more like martial type classes or limit things greatly, it would be a very interesting and different campaign, I'm sure. But again, especially with D&D, probably not the best system for that type of thing. But high and low magic systems are very interesting for Dungeons & Dragons. High magic is kind of the default, right? That's going to be your Forgotten Realms. Magic is kind of everywhere. People are very aware of magic. Most any adventure you run, like from a module or something, from Wizards, is going to be a high magic setting. I think Wizards specifically has a few settings that are low magic, but I do not believe any of those have really been tapped for 5e. Yeah, what is it? Dark Sun, or something that's a, kind of a lower magic setting.
I think you're right.
But that really hasn't been touched in 5e yet. So pretty much anything you play officially is going to be a high magic setting. High magic settings are things where magic items are plentiful. The normal populace is aware of spells and magic, and perhaps even can generally do it in some, you know, like novice type way. Maybe cantrips are extremely common and many people know them. Or magic items are used around the house. You know, just think of your Fantasia Mickey with the broom that goes around and does his bidding until he loses control of it. But that type of thing, that would be a very high magic setting. A really good example of that would be the Exandria Unlimited Calamity. I know we've talked about that before in some episodes. I'm trying to remember what the cities, and it wasn't Aeor. It was you're drawing a blank too, aren't you?
Yeah.
whatever city it was, it's just one of those. It's a flying, floating, magical city. The entire populace is very used to all these magical devices that are just all throughout the city. Spells are very common. These automatons and animated objects are all very common.
Avalir.
Avalir?
The city of Avalir.
Okay. So it that would be an example of an extremely high magic setting. So Ben, what are the like really like fun like pros of playing or setting your campaign in a very high magic setting?
Well, first of all, I mean, you're not limiting your players in any sort of way character wise. So, you know, whether it be wizard, sorcerer, warlock, cleric, paladin, whatever, you know, anything that has sort of magic involved with it, you know, they can kind of have free range. That's one of the best things. On top of that, like you said, magic items are plentiful. You know, they're everywhere. You can find different things. Depending on how rare it is, of course, that something might be a little bit harder to find or come across or something along those lines. You're peppering the world with fun stuff. Great. This means that you can have eccentric magic shop openers or owners because, hey, they own and are around all this random stuff. You know, I always think wacky mad scientist is a good way to go for a magic shop owner just because, you know, they've had to try the stuff. They have to know about it and everything, like something knowledgeable, but also, you know, with that little bit of crazy in there is always a lot of fun. You can throw in a bunch of random, cool, new, like NPC types. Like, in one of my cities, a magic shop owner happens to be an awakened German shepherd, Herman. He owns and operates a magic shop, you know, because why not? Why not have a talking awakened dog run a shop? On top of that too, there's just a lot of different things that you can add, not just for flavor, but for like danger, for adventuring, for, you know, story hooks. You know, imagine walking into a town where all of a sudden, like, you know, no magic exists. What's going on there? You know, trying to figure it out. Or what if magic is too powerful? You know, you can go both ways in something when you're kind of dialing up or dialing down something that is a common thing so that you have lots of different options there. On top of that, you have great villains who are able to, you know, cast sling spells and do things at the same time. You're able to teleport places, so you don't have to worry about really boring travel all the time. That's a good part. Airships deal with magic. Those are fun on top of that. There's any number of just wonderful magical creatures that are out there too. As well as like plane hopping, jumping to different, planes in the multiverse and stuff. Having magic available just opens up a lot of doorways that you wouldn't have access to without some sort of, you know, mystical operation going on.
Yeah. And I like you said, I think, this type of thing, at least from a D&D perspective, is going to be the widest open for your players as far as creating character concepts, having fun with it, opening up those role play opportunities, or just allowing various shenanigans. Like, just as an example, my world is a fairly high magic world. My homebrew world. And one of the players has, I believe the spell is Encode Thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up playing it, because he had a really good idea. So we ended up playing it a bit like, the way they do it in Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Where you can put the finger to the head and pull the memory out. And we created a pensive like magic item that we could then use to play back those memories with a few like different quirks. One of them being all the memories that go into it, the person only remembers it for the next hour. So they have to write down the important facts, but you can show other people as well, which is super cool. So, but to actually like retrieve, like once you pull the memory out, it's like gone from your head. And so there's that little blank spot. So you have to keep a record of your memories that are in there so that you can play them back. So it's super cool. Has already allowed for some really, really insane role play that we've done so far. But that's an example of a like something like that probably is not going to happen in a lower magic setting. Mm-hmm. And the player wouldn't have had necessarily that freedom to create something like that. So for D&D specifically, high magic settings make a lot of sense. It's made to work with the system, and it just works well. That's kind of what it was built for, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have low magic settings. And these can be really interesting too. Remember, when you're doing this, you want to pick this at the start, right? You want to pick this at the start. You want to let your players know what type of a game this is, because a low magic game is going to be a lot different than a high magic game. You might have to limit potentially classes. You might have to limit the ability to find magic items. You might have to limit things like the availability of resurrection. Mm-hmm. NPCs will react very different to someone who is casting magic in a low magic world than they would in a high magic world. Maybe in a low magic world, magic is feared, right? And anybody who is caught casting stuff is just automatically labeled bad, or automatically people are afraid of them because of this power that they wield. I think that would probably be one of the biggest reasons to run like a low magic campaign, is because it would provide some very strong, very interesting role play opportunities that don't exist as much in your normal run of the mill D&D high magic world.
Yeah. One of the neat things about that is that you can even have a low magic setting in a high magic world. It could be something where magic has been outlawed in a certain country, and any practitioners, like you said, are feared or ostracized or something along those lines, like just straight up right away. And in that case, playing a character who, you know, is especially something like a sorcerer, where it's just completely innate to them. In fact, playing a wild magic sorcerer would be even cooler in some sort of situation like that, because you can definitely get yourself into some sticky situations completely by accident. You know, maybe even add some flavor in there that it's wild magic because you're trying to suppress your magical nature or something, you know, just kind of go along with that. But the idea of, you know, trying to subtly hide that you're able to cast something, or, you know, you randomly charm someone, but a little kid kind of watches and sees you wiggle your fingers around, and then they kind of realize what you're doing, and then is either just completely in awe of you or runs away screaming to their mom, who then sees what you're doing and then calls the town guard or something along those lines. Like, there's a lot that can be done with a low magic setting to make it interesting, like Ryan was saying. But the biggest thing, and you know, Ryan, you did to start off with this, is that it needs to be discussed in a session zero. You know, I don't want to go in with my amazing wizard that I've decided that I want to play, who I have these, you know, perfect spells set up. These are what I want. This is what I want to do. This is my high concept of this wizard. He is, you know, trained in magic his whole life and everything. And then it turns out we're smack dab in a world where magic is incredibly rare or against the law, or, you know, any sort of thing like that, where you just automatically stand out like a beacon of, hey, I don't belong here. You know, no one wants to be put in that situation without their knowledge. So, you know, having,
you gotta have the buy-in.
Yeah, exactly.
You gotta have the buy-in for sure. There are certainly lots of resources for running lore magic campaigns. I think I've shouted out Monty Cook's like newsletter before. But he's got like the weekly like 10 top 10 D&D things for the week. And there have just been some absolutely amazing articles. I mean, we're going to talk about one of them later that I found and read from the newsletter that have kind of information and tips for running stuff like this. But if you have a very strong role play group, especially if you are very strong in like improv and role play, a low magic setting can open up a lot of really interesting story type potential things that you might not necessarily be able to get before. Heck, you could even do something fun where the beginning of your campaign is post a giant cataclysm, where everything that was a high magic world, but now it's not. And dealing with the fallout of that and the characters potentially rediscovering some of this stuff that was lost. So you could totally play, I mean, one of many angles like that. But that's, I feel like if I were to do something like that, I think that would be a really interesting, fun hook. The, like, you know, level one, level twos, whatever, picking up the pieces after this cataclysm. Maybe all the characters were super powerful or used to be super powerful casters or, you know, druids or whatever. And magic has just been lost to a large extent. And this is them discovering, picking the pieces back up. And figuring out how to restore what was lost. So there's a lot of different ways you could run something like that while kind of keeping within your D&D setting and still allowing players to have that freedom of choice.
Yeah, and especially something along those lines where, you know, if they were powerful casters or something, now that's gone and they have to turn to a different source, whether that's, you know, maybe they used to be the graduating class in a wizarding school and some sort of cataclysm came. Well, now they're starting to pick up like druidic magic or, you know, someone's deciding to do, you know, more of a celestial type of, you know, like holy magic, you know, going the way of a paladin or a cleric. I couldn't think of the name. Or even more so, what if they're turning into, you know, making deals with patrons? That's a perfect example of, you know, a warlock who's slowly gaining power as they're leveling up because they lost what they had and they're trying to get it back. You know, I like that idea of just reclaiming what you had or else trying to bring back to the world what was lost. You know, it's a really good story hook. Or even, you know, discovering magic in the world and opening it up to like the masses of some sort. You know, you have a couple different ways of just looking at it that way. And having just those sorts of options in a low magic setting kind of gives you a lot to play with as well, just because, you know, you have a lot of different paths and ways of trying to discover or find the magic or get to it or get more of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, either way you look at it, with a high magical world, which, to be honest, that's kind of my preference, just because I love the fact that in the real world, there's no magic. So therefore, in my imaginary one that I'm making, magic's everywhere. I've got an inn that when you walk inside, it's run by halflings, where if you walk inside, everyone gets shrunk down to the proportions of a halfling so that they don't need to have different size rooms. You know, and it's got air conditioning. It's got all these different other magical things to it. Inside, it expands to the amount of rooms needed for however many people are in there. You know, like, I can do this because the world's full of magic. Can't do that in another place, but that brings a bunch of different types of challenges and different kinds of storytelling that you can play with as well. You know, instead, okay, well, guess what? This adventuring party gets to this inn run by halflings, but guess what? Everything's halfling sized. They've got to try to get a comfortable night's sleep on a halfling sized bed. They have to have dinner at a halfling sized table, you know, just quirky, fun stuff can come out of these things as well. It's how you kind of roll with it and look at it as not exactly a problem, not exactly a solution, but just this is the setting that I'm going with. So I'm going to create around that.
You know, one thing that kind of came up to mind while we've been talking about this, have you heard of Shadowrun
before? I've heard of it before. I never played it though.
So Shadowrun is a little bit more like modern day futuristic type thing where mm-hmm. like magic kind of awakens basically. And then like people are turning into orcs and elves and magic is happening. And I was just thinking, you know, that's another really cool, could be another really cool idea slash setting for a lower magic campaign, set in a world where magic doesn't exist. And then it does. And it's slowly doing these things. It would make a lot of sense from just like that level one player, or even, you know, there's some supplements starting level zero, right? You are just run of the mill people, right?
That are then
slowly, these things are awakening around you. And, the world is becoming different. The world is changing. Magic is real. I could totally see that being a really interesting, like fantasy type version of a Shadowrun type story.
Yeah. And then just as you were talking about that, so I've been watching a lot of X-Men 97 every week with new episodes that have been coming out, and it's been amazing.
As you should, it's very good.
Yeah. That is a no magic setting kind of world. But when you throw in, you know, mutants with their different powers and abilities, just make that magic, you know, make your own sort of world where, again, not everybody has it. Maybe, again, magic is feared. Have your characters maybe kind of theme themselves out, you know, to kind of try to go with some sort of idea or ideology when they're leveling up, when they're choosing spells, when they're doing different things, to kind of give them, you know, that sort of experience of like, you're a unique individual in a non-magical world. How do you react? How do you feel about it? You know, it's another type of setting that you can kind of play around with and see how it goes.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot that you could do with it. And, this is the part in the show where you say, we want to hear from you. Have you run a low magic campaign before? Have you played in one? We would love to hear how it went. Like, what did you do? How was the setting? What different custom rules did you have or did you not? Because the NPCs and did the NPCs react accordingly, that sort of thing. So if you've got stories like that, we would absolutely love to hear that in our email or in our Discord. Please let us know. But it's not something I've run yet. It's not something I've necessarily played in. I think it's something that I would love to kind of dip my toes into with like a one shot at some point.
Yeah, that can be fun.
Because I'm almost positive if I just spend, you know, 5 or 10 minutes looking, I can probably find a pretty good one on like DM's Guild or something that's like a one shot run in a low magic type setting. So, it's certainly an interesting topic. And it's, again, it's a foundational thing, usually from the beginning of your campaign. So if that sounds interesting, maybe give it a try. And if I find like a good one shot, I'll make sure to have that and shout it out next episode, because it's probably something I'll end up looking for.
It's funny because we'll talk much more about this in an episode or two. But so I've been reading through Of Dice and Men, which we mentioned, I think, one or two episodes ago. Yep, and knowing that D&D started from wargaming, where like magic and all that stuff definitely was not there, talking about like a low magic or no magic setting, I'm just like, it's kind of going back into that where, you know, it evolved from there into this high magic world and stuff. It's a really interesting kind of contrast, but seeing the different opportunities that could come of it is, you know, interesting as well. And just an entirely different game style. And again, which is one of the reasons why 5th edition is such a good addition to really start and sink your teeth into.
Yeah, completely agree. All right, so speaking of magic, For our second topic today, we're actually going to be jumping into a monster fixture, specifically for enchanted objects and things like animated armor. This is animated armor is just like a legitimately classic D&D monster. This is in page 116 of the basic rules. Like this is just one of those things like, oh, you're in a castle and the hallway is lined with suits of armor, you know, weapons crisscrossed, hung up on the wall. And as you hit the middle of that hallway, all of a sudden, these suits of armor spring to life and attack you. The weapons break free from their clasps and come down and try and stab you or shred you or behead you. So, we thought we'd talk a little bit about those, how to create them, making them fun to run. And I wanted to start with just the classic animated armor because it's such a cool concept. I mean, it's a challenge rating 1. So this is not a super like scary, strong thing. This is not something that you probably your higher level players will be fighting against. Although you could easily come up with ways to scale this sort of thing upright, but it's, again, like many things, especially from the basic rules, a very generic stat block. It's got its false appearance, obviously, because it looks like armor, and then until it starts moving, and then you're just like, oh god, that's not armor. It's got its anti-magic susceptibility, you know, if it targets this like a dispel magic, it could fall unconscious for a minute. But otherwise, it's basically, it's got 2 slam attacks. That's it.
Yay.
So let's spice this thing up. Like this is because this is way more interesting. So one of the things I was thinking of would be something called like Puppet Master, where the target has to make maybe like a dex save or maybe a strength save. And if they fail, the armor splits apart and then like jumps onto you.
Okay.
And controls your actions for a turn before springing off and doing it. Because remember, and this is me talking, I am not a huge fan of long lasting stun type effects. Mm-hmm. But it also, those short-term ones can make for really interesting play because then you get that, oh no, type thing. Or and the fun thing is, as a DM, you can still give agency to your players to an extent when these type of effects are on them, because you can go, okay, the armor is on you. It is trying to repel intruders. And then it's just like, which intruder would you like to attack, or who do you, or what would you like to do to try and stop these intruders? Or, you know, you see a sword nearby that you can grab and pick up. Who are you going to go for? That type of thing. Or even give them a little list of cool things that they can do while they're puppeted. So at the very least, that's them playing the monster's kind of stat block for a short period of time versus them losing all agency and just losing a turn.
Yeah. And on top of that too, they can also affect certain abilities and things that the armor would do. Like if you have like a strength roll, that succeeds in some form, you can cause an attack to have disadvantage because, you know, you're fighting against that swing of a sword, or, you know, maybe you try to hinder the movement so it doesn't move as far or something along those lines. You know, give them a couple different active things that they can do, so it doesn't like punish them for it. Kind of going along with that, I thought that it would be really interesting to look at the magic itself that's like enchanting this armor. And because of that, like, well, first of all, I think it should have some sort of magic resistance because, you know, it's being fueled by arcane you know, magic and enchanted, an enchantment of some sort. But even more so, what if it could absorb either magical attacks that are coming at it, or absorb, like, you know, maybe spell slots from a character or something to make itself more powerful for its next attack, whether that's going to be, you know, it's swinging its sword harder, or if it has like some sort of arcane burst that it can, you know, like shoot out of it. It's fueled by pure magic, so why not attack with that after pulling some in? On top of that too, make it entirely tied to what it does. If it expends a bunch of magic, maybe all of a sudden its legs aren't working as well because it's not enchanted as strongly anymore. So, you know, give it maybe half speed, or maybe one of its arms no longer works because it expended so much energy just trying to attack one character that it's got to leech again and pull off of another one in order to get that, you know, arm ability back in. You know, really look at how is magic affecting this thing and what could it do with that power. I mean, I'm not really talking Emperor Palpatine, unlimited power, throwing force lightning all the time, but you know, something along those lines would be kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think having something to do with this is run by magic, perhaps it can use that magic in a certain way. Magic absorption is another thing I had thought about for this type of thing. your players might hate you. Spell reflection.
Oh yeah.
Spell reflection is, I don't think that's actually I think the new 2024 monk is kind of getting a little something like that. Being able to not just catch projectiles, but like, you know, any ranged attack type thing.
I think you're right.
But having some sort of a spell reflect thing for these animated objects does seem like it would be a very interesting like reaction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it has to make a certain DC. Maybe it has to beat your spell save DC specifically. Or maybe you have to make some sort of a check to push it through to not be reflected. But I love the idea of like magic missiles shooting out and then they just hit this barrier and start flying like every which way, potentially putting other people in harm's way. It's the I think Critical Role did one of these really well. I think it was Campaign 2. They had like an animated golem type thing that was like a very just anti-caster. I think it was kind of the Aeor thing. Maybe that's where I was thinking of it. But it basically had all sorts of things to try and stop casters from doing things or absorb things or dispel things. So adding those types of things to an animated object kind of like this is always very fun and surprising as well.
Definitely.
Got to keep players on their toes.
Exactly. So aside from armor, you can find a couple things in the monster manual. Like, there's the rug of smothering. I think there's like a enchanted table. That was
so fun.
Yeah.
Have you used one before?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I have totally gotten to use one before. I highly recommend rug of smothering. Any of the mundane looking objects that, are great for like traps in places or like a wizard's tower, or this one was in like a noble house in their room.
Oh yeah.
And the characters were trying to heist something from it. And one of the characters stepped on it, got wrapped up and accidentally got pushed into the fireplace. That was super fun. There's so many shenanigans that can happen from like Rugs is smothering, but yeah, yeah. Those sorts of things are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, we had something very similar to that too, where a rug was going after someone and the table was clattering towards them as well. And they just booked it out. They grabbed what they needed and got out of the room so that it was like banging on the door trying to get to them. But of course, it's a table. It can't open doors. So it was stuck in there. But aside from the things that you can find in the Monster Manual, again, we're looking at like a high fantasy world here. So you can put an enchantment on pretty much anything that you want. You know, all you need to do is think of, you know, some sort of abilities that it could possibly have, you know, have a book, be able to just kind of fling itself off of a desk at someone, you know, and then maybe have it like clamp onto a leg or, you know, their ankle or something after it's on the floor. Have, you know, floating swords from a coat of arms just kind of pop off the wall and attack. I mean, you have a spiritual weapon, just, you know, use the same sort of stats on that, but make it a floating sword of some sort. You know, there's plenty of different things that you can do to just create more of a challenge and think creatively based off of, you know, just looking around your room right now. Like, I've got a bunch of Funko Pops. What if they all animated and started attacking me? Okay, that'd be terrifying.
That'd be terrifying. If you think about it, it's a very, you could easily have a very like Beauty and the Beast type situation.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Where this whole castle, like everything is animated, and some things are helpful and some things are not helpful and want to kill you. That would be a super cool setting for something. Or a little one shot or something.
Oh, like yeah. That. Imagine if you walked in and one wing of the castle was at war with another wing, and the items in the west wing were fighting the items in the east wing, and you had to kind of, you know, side with one of them in order to be able to get to whatever MacGuffin you're searching for in this, you know, run down, broken up castle.
Run! It's the couches!
Clomp, 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 clomp.
Yeah,
clomp,
yeah, yeah. I mean, heck, I'm trying to remember which one, Never After, Dimension 20, Never After. One of the first big battles they had was with like these animated objects, like beds and tables and barrels and stuff like that. You want to like lesson in like terrifying type low level type combat, definitely check that out. That was quite the deal.
Yeah, in campaign 3 of Critical Role, like one of the first episodes that like brought all the characters together was just kind of random stuff on the street, just inanimate objects attacking everybody, and that put them on their entire path together, which is very different now than what it was at the beginning of that series. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things, is that you've got stat blocks for so many different things in your Monster Manual, in even the DM's guide. And you can take any of those things and just kind of incorporate it and change it into, you know, some sort of animated objects that, you know, you can just kind of mess around with. You know, look at something that has a bunch of bludgeoning damage and turn it into slashing damage. And all of a sudden you have your enchanted sword that's floating after people. Or you go into the castle and you find your way into the kitchen, and all of a sudden the stove is alive and going after everybody, you know, with like flame attacks of some sort. You know, there's just a lot of creativity and stuff that you can do based or just with everyday objects. And it's kind of fun if you get into one of those really highly magical situations of everything's enchanted. Watch out. Now I really want to have
super fun.
I really want to have a Beauty and the Beast castle somewhere in my world now, where everything's just alive just because. Like, I'm not going to do the Beauty and the Beast story at all. It's just things are alive just because.
It's just a castle where it's no people. It's just the stuff in the castle.
Yeah. They didn't even used to be people. They have no concept of actual humanity or morality or anything. They're just there trying to survive.
A magically charged castle with a bunch of just stuff. I do love the idea that for hundreds of years, one side of the castle has been at war with the other side of the castle.
Oh yeah. It definitely opens up just a lot of like interesting rivalries. You can have some sort of like Romeo and Juliet romance between like two little small items, and they're trying to, you know, make peace and broker it between the two different wings and stuff. I love this.
Yeah, the spoons.
Yeah, exactly.
So they can spoon.
Yeah, there's the fancy spoon, and then like the normal kitchen staff spoon. You know, one side is the lap of luxury, the other side is like the common man. And oh my gosh, I'm doing a whole
like, I'm taking notes.
Exactly. You know what?
Taking notes right now.
And make it a campaign setting where your characters are spoons or whatever too. You can even do that if you wanted to.
I mean, they've got the little, I mean, there's already settings like that where, like Humblewood, where you're just all animals.
Exactly.
And stuff, right?
So basically you're playing Toy Story, but Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I feel like we veered off somewhere. But
yeah,
a little bit. The whole point is animated stuff is cool, and there's a lot you can do with it.
Yes, a whole lot. Oh my gosh. Literally, your imagination is the limit on them.
But I think some of the stuff we talked about kind of leads into our community shout out for this episode, which I got from the newsletter. And it's an article called from the website Dubstat Adventures called "Keep It Risky or Lose the Fun." And it's a really good article because it talks about how minimizing risk can lead to very like meh outcomes. Mm-hmm. Because part of the whole idea of Dungeons and Dragons, part of the whole idea of rolling dice for anything, is that element of random chance. And knowing that sometimes you're not going to get the outcome that you're desiring, right? And then beyond that, how do you overcome that outcome? Or how do you deal with that outcome? So it's a great article that just talks about how risk creates fun. Without risk, there isn't suspension, there isn't anticipation, there isn't fun. And again, this is very generalized, right? There are some campaigns people run where the whole idea is, no, I don't want my character to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I have played in a game for a short time that was like that. It wasn't for me, because I felt the exact same way that this article is, but some people enjoy that play style. If they want that, I just want to be immersed in this like RP type world. And your combat is more just for how do you do the thing rather than the outcome of the thing. Sure. That's fine. If that's the play style you like, that's great. Personally, that is not a play style for me. But I highly recommend DMs read this article, because it is a great talk to how to keep things risky, how to make things interesting, why risk is fun.
Yeah. And this is a lesson that I learned very quickly, because before I was DMing 5th edition, I did DM 4th edition a couple times, just because, you know, I wanted to play, and I had some friends who we would get together like once every 5-6 months or something and play like a session. And I was very much in the whole like, okay, I don't want these people to ever die, because where's the fun in that? And combat was just a waste of time, because, you know, I knew that they were going to get through it. This is back when like I would fudge rolls a lot of the time, where, you know, I'd get a 20 or like an at 20, like, oh no, I didn't get an at 20, or oh, I missed every single time or something like that, because, you know, I thought, oh, they're getting low on their health, I don't want them to die, we're not going to worry about this. And even in my players, it just, you know, they weren't having as much fun as they could. You know, those combats didn't matter at all. They were going to make it through. Nothing was really challenging. And it was just kind of a walk in the park. So when I started DMing fifth edition and, you know, we went from the one shot to an actual campaign, I'm like, okay, I'm not fudging my rolls and at all this time. You know, if I get a nat 20, I get a nat 20. If I do miss, I miss. You know, this is just kind of how it plays out. And it took a long time for me to really kind of, you know, get to the point where I felt, where I understood my characters, how they play, and, you know, kind of like the CR ratings and things like that before I started getting to the point where I felt comfortable with what I was throwing at them because, you know, they're actually taking damage now. There's actually risk involved in any sort of combats. But even more on top of that, you know, I'm always happy that my players are incredibly intelligent and they're able to come up with, you know, amazing plans and bypass stuff and everything like that. But sometimes I just want them to do the really out of left field plan just to see what would happen, because I think it would make a more interesting story, or, you know, give a lot more that they could do RP wise, you know, to try to like get themselves out of a bad situation or something along those lines. Granted, again, they're successful and a lot of the plans that they come up with are amazing and are just so outside the box that they get good credit for that. But when, you know, it's just kind of a, well, what should we do? And there's this crazy plan over here and this other one over here that's just kind of like, okay, well, it'll probably work. Go with the crazy one, guys. And if you're still listening to the show, just every now and then, just go with the crazy one. We'll see what happens. But like, again, overall, so happy with their plans on how things would work. In fact, I have something to talk about when we get to what we've been playing, because it's just one of those things where I freaking love my group and the ideas that they come up with. So anyways,
I mean, Ben, I think we've hit that point in the show. I think we've hit that point because I know for you, this has been months upon months.
It has
incoming due to real life things, adult things, sickness things, all the things that just make that scheduling monster so incredibly hard. So You're back for the first time in months. So what is up? How was it? Did it feel good to be back? Did you have a good time? Did everyone have a lot of fun?
I had a blast. And it was definitely something that was not expected. So first of all, who would have thought that a trip to the hospitals and staying for a couple of days could really just throw you out of D&D for a while? I didn't think so, but then the world happened. Anyways... So in our previous session, we had just gotten, our sorcerer, their like, you know, big artifact. They're going on, you know, everybody kind of has a god choosing them to be their champion. They're getting an artifact. You know, there's this big, huge, thing happening there. There's a gigantic lore dump at the last, or at the end of the last session, which of course no one remembered because it's been like 6 months. So of course I started off with like a big recap of kind of, you know, where they started, where they are now, and, gave, you know, reasons on why things are in the state of the world that they are, which is basically the, you know, the divine gate, if you want to call it that, or the protection around the world, around the material plane has cracks in it because of this demigod that they had, originally defeated, it had started breaking through. But one of the biggest cracks is in this area where the like the original casting of this protection started, which is this far off horrible wasteland called Ormar, which eventually I'm assuming they're going to get there at some point. Who knows? We'll see what actually happens with the story. But the whole point is that they're gathering these relics so that they can use the power in them to undergo this ritual to, you know, strengthen the barrier and fix the cracks and everything that's been happening. So that being said, they just got an artifact. Now they're back at home. And so they get there and they're standing outside of their manor that was a gift to them from, you know, saving the city from that demigod. And the door's slightly open. So like, oh man. So they're getting ready to go in. And it turns out it's just the maid, you know, So she says, oh, I thought that you were here earlier because, you know, rumors around town are that the adventurers are back. And, you know, I heard that about, you know, like 5 hours ago or something. So they're like, what? You know, they're realizing other adventurers, what's going on? Because they know that there is another group out there, like an evil side, who are also going through and trying to collect relics for whatever reason that they're doing it. And, you know, who knows? They don't know exactly. You know, they've had a run-in with them once or twice, as well as that group leader, which is a female drow that they've definitely run into a couple times. In fact, they were there when she found her relic that she was going for. So they find out where these adventurers are and what's going on. And they're in like the elven district of this town, you know, like a very rich area. They head over there and they walk in, and I'm starting to describe these four adventuring figures. And it turns out it's a family, and, you know, they all kind of look alike and everything. And suddenly I see the face of my paladin have a recollection of, oh, there's no way that this is happening, but it was. So her family's in town. And in her backstory, she talked about how, you know, growing up with this adventuring family, they went through, they, you know, did tasks for people, you know, were doing good. But as she was grew up around them, she realized that they would only take, you know, jobs that had the highest pay. They would only, you know, they're really in it for themselves, trying to get rich, trying to raise the notoriety of the family name and things like that. So, she ended up kind of talking with her young, or the youngest of the sons, which is her, like the middle child. So her older brother. And he was like, oh yeah, you know, we're in town. We heard about what you did with this demigod. And basically he was like, you know, how did you pull that off? Thinking, how did you grift this town to do, you know, to get, you know, that much notoriety and stuff? Because our bard in our group is constantly singing praises about the group and about the paladin. And, you know, so of course these are starting to spread across the continent and everything. So, you know, they kind of came to the whole, like, oh no, this is real. What we're doing, this is, you know, we're not in it for the money, even though they have tons of wealth at this point, but you know, we're not in it for the money, doing all that stuff. And then it turns out that the family had planted something in a very rich house that was making quote unquote ghosts appear. So of course, you know, my group was like, okay, no, we're going to go take care of this because you're doing something wrong. We're going to put a stop to it. We're going to make sure that everything's good. So the dad comes down the stairs from the inn. He says, did someone say there's trouble? And, like, you know, definitely putting on a huge whole act for the inn and everything. And then it was absolutely fantastic. And first of all, the paladin just role-playing all this out kind of back and forth, introducing, you know, the family to the party and stuff was great. And she and I had a really good, like, back and forth, and totally went with a yes and for everything. Like, I didn't fully know how I was going to flesh out each of the characters until, like, it started when she was interacting with them. So anyway, so they get to this mansion, and this is the first time that I've used the map feature on D&D Beyond. And I gotta say,
how did that go?
I loved it. It was great. It has all the different, you know, tools and stuff that Owlbear Rodeo has at this point. So it was just like, you know, right there. And in fact, it was kind of easier to do too. I actually really enjoyed it. As soon as you, like, you know, you start the session, you know, the map will pop up for everybody. You can actually pause the session now, and then it disappears for them. You can, like, switch maps out and do different things. So that's a new feature that's pretty cool. The one thing is that while it was in session, when I was removing the fog of war, like, my cursor was going slow, like it was lagging behind. So, like, that's the one thing that kind of was annoying. But besides that, it was great. Absolutely loved using the maps feature on D&D Beyond. That is definitely what I'm using going forward.
Nice that it was integrated with your campaign and the characters and such.
Exactly. I gave them the map link and everything was there, and they were able to, I mean, they can move all the different pieces, which was really helpful because one of my characters has a familiar. So she was able to move them because I had sized the square to, you know, the size of the square of the map, because it was a pretty big map. Everything is sized accordingly. So when you pull out a token, if it's a giant creature, it's a giant creature on the map automatically. You don't have to resize anything or anything like that. It's really cool. So anyway, so we get to the map, they kind of get inside, and the the younger of the brothers, kind of takes them in. She forced her mom, dad, and oldest brother to stay outside because like they're just going to steal stuff and everything. So they go inside and there's all these apparitions around. But it turns out that they had an artificer had created this orb where you push a button and like runes glow on the side. And basically it kind of lowers the barrier between the close ethereal or something like that, basically the ethereal plane. So they can see like kind of these denizens going around, you know. If you ever saw the Doctor Who episode with like the ghosts that were going around that turned out to be Cybermen, it's kind of like that whole thing where, you know, they couldn't interact with anything very well, but you know, they were there, you can see them. And the idea was that you click it again within 30 seconds, all of them disappear. They're gone. So the idea was make these people think their house is haunted, come in, remove them and get a whole bunch of money. It's basically like what Walter Peck thought the Ghostbusters were doing in the original Ghostbusters. But, you know, of course, they're real. So he picks up the thing. He's trying to turn it off, and it's not turning off. This is all because the barriers between, you know, planes and stuff was cracked and is breaking in this area of the world because of what happened with this demigod. So then these other things ripped a crack into, like, you know, just space, just floating there, and came out and started attacking. And on top of that, they heard this roar, this loud roar, like something's coming. So like, oh crap. So basically they're trying to kill this thing and figure out how to close this crack, especially with the orb wasn't working. Now, me being the DM that I am, when there's puzzles like this, I don't like coming up with solutions because I don't want to stick with that solution. And that's the only way to do it because my players are so creative. I like having them come up with ideas on how to, you know, to do these things. So my cleric, the brilliant man that he is, he's like, I'm going to cast Dispel Magic on this crack at 6th level, like highest spell level that he's got right now. So I'm like, okay, cool. Roll, because he's a cleric, I'm like, either Religion or Arcana. So he rolled really high, did great. So I'm like, okay, because he did that, the crack, it's starting to close. It closed a certain amount. So instead of being like, you know, gigantically open, it's about maybe a third of the way closed now. And then again, they hear this roar and it's coming and everything. And then the bard sees this. So she does the same thing, closes it even more. And it turns out that it's a good thing she did that because at that point there's another roar that happened and this long apparition-y like kind of arm busts through and scratches her up and everything. Whatever it is, isn't able to fully get through the crack because they, you know, shrunk it.
Nice.
And then
nice.
Finally, they end up sealing the crack and they turn the thing off and then like destroyed the orb. So because of that smart thinking, I'm like, that was awesome. I was going to have just kind of a reskinned ghost dragon bust through and attack them and like kind of, you know, attack the family and stuff like that. But because they were already closing the crack, I'm like, we're rewarding this. This is going to be awesome. So with all that happening, they ended up taking the family back to their manor, or the party's manor. They had a good talking to him and everything. Basically the family disowned her, except the youngest of the brothers stayed, had remorse. He wanted to change his ways and everything like that. So the mom, the dad, eldest brother left, he stayed. He's going to, you know, try to become the better person that his sister is. And that's kind of where we left it off with some information on where potentially the next artifact is, which, spoiler alert, and they know this, it's in the Shadowfell. So we're going to have a little adventure there and see what happens.
Oh, boy, could I tell you a thing or two about the Shadowfell.
I know. So I'm going to see how my version compares to yours. I'm excited. But yeah, the thing is because it had been so long, like I didn't want to have a really big, long, drawn out combat thing because it's been so long, you know, people need to kind of get reacquainted with their skills and abilities and stuff. And on top of that too, I wanted something, you know, kind of fun, kind of unexpected, but not end of the world ending kind of stuff. So I think I did a pretty good, you know, kind of return to it. And I was able to pull from someone's backstory and kind of integrate it into the world. And it worked out really well. I had a blast because, you know, DMing again for the first time in a long time. And I think everybody else had a pretty good job too, or had a good time. So It worked out really well, and I'm excited to play again, which we're playing this Saturday, so 1 week later, because the next few weeks are super busy when we weren't able to get together. So yeah, it's going to be good, and we'll see what's going on in the Shadowfell.
That's awesome. Man, sounds like you had a blast and a big bang for your first session back in a long time.
It was pretty good.
Did everyone remember how to play their characters?
They actually did a really good job. Everybody did good. For the week beforehand, I dropped a couple, like, get reacquainted with your character. Think like your character, like, you know, like prompts in our Discord.
Don't forget to check your character sheets again.
Yeah. But, you know, I did a couple things like to get him back in the mindset. I was like, you know, what's something crazy that your character did when they were a kid? And, you know, just like different things like that to kind of, you know, just have those little exercises, which
I love that. That's a great idea. That's a great idea of after like longer breaks to help get back into character for sure.
Yeah, in fact, the ones I specifically did, I can actually tell you. Let's see. The first one I did was, what stupid things did you do when you were younger? And then I did, who is your most trusted ally? And then what do you think others generally perceive, or how do you think others generally perceive you? I figured those were pretty good.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Pretty good ones to kind of get them back in that same mindset. So it worked out pretty well.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. How about you though? I mean, you've got a lot of stuff going on in your world.
I do have lots of stuff going on. There's fires. There's lots of fires. I did something that I do every once in a while where we had a split session where we basically jumped around to different people's point of views in different locations before bringing everybody back together. So that was super fun. It just ended up being that two of the characters were in the same spot and the other two were in a different spot. And one set of characters had to deal with a fire in the building they were staying in. Oh. And not just that, but like being trapped and having other people trapped in there with them as well.
Wow.
That they had to try and rescue, or if they wanted to, which they did end up doing. And then the other one where someone was trying to start a fire in their place of business, but they caught him in the act. And so they had this like impromptu battle and stuff, which was super cool. While they were going in, that was why I brought up the little pensive type thing. Because I did this all theater of the mind, which I love doing for the smaller scale stuff where there's not a ton of like enemies and stuff to keep track of, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel like in some ways it makes it them think more creative. Because I can say, you're in your room. What would you have in your room? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
To do stuff with.
And it's all enchanted.
Yeah, so the basically it ended up where they fought this thing. It was trying to escape, and one of the characters threw that pensive thing down a flight of stairs after it.
Oh, wow.
Caught it in the memory and got it stuck there so that they could finish it off.
Oh, that's great.
So that was super, super cool. Just like a use that I had never thought of for that type of thing. But we kind of, you know, made it up, mechanics up on the fly, and it worked out so well. It was just so thematic and just such a cool story beat. So it was a lot of fun. I'm playing again in 2 days. Because we usually record Wednesday night, so I'm playing again on Friday. I've got a really cool handout that I made for the newspaper that I'll be able to hand them to read the day's
so
newspaper,
jealous of that.
Which is so much fun. It's just such a cool thing to be able to do. So there'll be a lot of things to play off of that, because like I said, it's a very unique campaign in which the characters all have lives.
Yeah.
They all have like houses. They have friends and family. They have jobs. So it's a very different campaign style than I've ever ran before. Because we're not just wandering through the wilderness, going from town to town and adventuring and, you know, having adventuring days and fighting random creatures and crap all over the place. Now, it's a very specific location with very built-in characters, which is super fun.
That's awesome. I'm glad that you're really having a good time with that and, you know, experimenting and trying something different. It sounds like it's really rewarding to the players as well, especially since they're, you know, leaning a lot more into RP and just, you know, able to help build the city and the world around them at the same time as playing.
It's certainly not for the RP faint of heart. Like this is definitely one of my highest role play campaigns that I've done so far. This is probably much more like a 60-40, 65-35, 70-30, like RP combat versus my normal like 50-50-ish style of running. But I have a very strong group of role players. So this is works out really well. There's already been some super fun NPCs, some that I've made, some that are from the player's creation that I was then able to take and do lots of fun stuff with.
That's awesome.
So I'm very excited. This is a campaign I certainly look forward to getting to run every other week. And I'm excited to see what comes of this next session for sure.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it looks like we're both playing this weekend.
Feels good, man.
Yes, it does.
Feels good. Feels good. I also have to shout out my Curse of Strahd campaign that I'm playing in, because I'm running one. I'm playing in one right now. And we're actually going to be having, as long as all goes well, my DM who runs Strahd on the show next episode to talk about running modules, to talk about adding things to existing modules, to talk about Curse of Strahd in general, to talk about running a horror, because it is a very horror based type campaign. That's a very dark, very macabre type campaign. And we had our first full on character death after having played for about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
This last session, which was a really, really big deal. And if you've ever DM'd Curse of Strahd, and I have purposefully not read much about Curse of Strahd simply because I'm playing in it and I don't want to be spoiled for it. But death is not a good thing in Curse of Strahd for the person who died.
I hear.
Yeah. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, because it was a very dramatic thing. It was a thing that had been building for a long, long time. And we ran out of luck. We ran out of time. So I'm sure Jeff will talk some about that in our next episode. So I don't want to steal his thunder, but I'm very much looking forward to that interview. That'll be a lot of fun as we get to talk about those type of things.
Definitely.
And with that, I believe that is an episode. So again, Ben, thank you so much for joining me. It's always great to get to talk D&D and tabletop RPGs with you. As always, though, before we go, why don't you tell everybody where we can be reached and where they can drop us a line on their cool stories, their questions, or even topics for the show.
Yeah, you bet. First and foremost, you know, we'd love to hear from you. And of course, again, if you have any, you know, high magic setting stories, low magic setting stories, no magic setting stories, send them to us. We want to hear about them, or anything else, or any sort of, you know, show topic suggestions, questions, anything along those lines. We are always looking at our email, which is dndiscussions@gmail.com. Anything you send there, we will definitely read, take a look at, digest, maybe think about it a while, possibly answer it in email form or answer it on the show, or maybe even both. You never know. That's why it's always a good idea to send us something. Now, if you're looking for something, you know, a bit, less wordy, less character-y, anything like that, you can always reach out to us on Blue Sky social media. The show is at DN Discussions. If you're looking for Ryan, he is at TBK Zord. And if you're looking for me, I am at Ben Bumhoffer. That being said, we don't really use our Twitter account anymore. In fact, I'll probably do one more post saying, hey, we've moved to Blue Sky. And then we're probably going to just, you know, either keep it there for forever or get rid of it or something. So that's why I haven't really been shouting that out. That's why we haven't been updating it, in case you follow us there. So definitely check us out on Blue Sky. Otherwise, you know what? You can always go to dndiscussions.com. That's our website. It has every single episode that we have, as well as links to all of our socials, including our Discord channel, which if you want to reach out there, we love talking to people on here. We've got a great little community that's growing, and we'd love to have you be... we would love to have you be part of it. Again, that link can be found on dndiscussions.com. Last but not least, if you want to listen to me play on an actual play podcast, you can listen to Plus Five to Hits. We are currently going through Rime of the Frost Maiden. We have been for a little while, taking breaks here and there. But it is a lot of fun. We are in a new area, a Nethery city, in fact. And going through and nearly dying, which is fun, and then also living through other stuff. So check that out, Plus Five to Hit. Last but not least, Ryan, it is always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining me on this episode of D&D Discussions, as well as coming up with ideas for me to talk about stuff, because as we've kind of said before, we can talk about the stuff forever. It's just full of rich conversation and tons of fun.
And a lot of times we get ideas from our own show as we're talking about things and thinking about them.
Exactly. And vice versa, too. Things that have happened in our games, like, ooh, we should talk about this on the show. It all over the place. It's its like own feeding, like Mobius strip. No, it's because it's not an Ouroboros. It doesn't eat its own tail because it's feeding each other. So we'll say it's the Orin from Neverending Story. How's that? I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go. And with that, everybody, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of DN Discussions. Make sure to leave, you know, positive comments, 5-star reviews, wherever you listen, because we love that and it helps grow the show. With that being said, everybody, make sure to roll high and be good to each other.
Take care, and we'll see you soon.